Welcome back, everyone, to the second half of our event today. I'm not sure whether we're complete yet, but we're going to make a start anyway to not undo the excellent timekeeping of the morning. I'm Andrea Einhaus. I'm on the advisory board, and Trini has very kindly asked me to chair our second keynote. We're very lucky to have Lucy Notes, who is Professor Rand Butler Professor of Modern History at the University of Essex. And actually, even to me as a First World War interloper at this event, is well known for her work on gender and war, which spans both wars. Generally, Lucy's interests span both world wars, from her two books on war and gender, which is how I first came to know her work myself, to work on British cultural memory, often on the Second World War, to no fewer than four current projects. Lucy's current work ranges from an investigation of British memory of the First World War at the point of the war's centenary, and a little plug will follow at the end of my introduction, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, to an exploration of the experience of total war, to a study of death, grief, and bereavement in Britain in the Second World War. Her paper today links to this latter project, which if you want to find out more about it, then you can stay tuned for the book version, the extended treatment, which will be titled Dying for the Nation, and will come out with MUP probably
late
2019.
Yeah,
I'm sure we'll be tweeting an update on that as well via the project Twitter account. So here's the little plug that I announced earlier. If you feel able, and I realise that not all of you will be First World War historians or folks more generally speaking, either, but if you feel able to, could you fill in the survey linked to Lucy's HSC-funded Reflections project, which looks at the centenary and sort of, reflections on the centenary of the First World War. Katrina is tweeting, or has tweeted, the link to the survey.
About to tweet.
Oh, and James has got some flyers.
Excellent. Even if you can't pick up either, if you go to the project website, you will find a link. That would be very helpful because ultimately the project relies on as many voices as possible to be heard in the survey. And of course, if you can't fill it in yourself, do please circulate the link to colleagues, people you know who might be able to fill it in. So Lucy's keynote today is entitled Burying the People of the People's War, A Forgotten History of Death in Wartime. And I will hand over to Lucy without further ado.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. Okay. I'm sure I don't need to remind anybody here, but death is central to the experience and to the history of warfare. As historians, I think we're fairly good at counting the dead. Richard Bessel at York has estimated the total dead of the Second World War at around about 60 million. That number including both military and civilian casualties, with, he argues, the majority being members of allied nations and in large measure being the populations of China and the Soviet Union. As historians, we're also fairly good at considering the ways that we remember and commemorate the dead, particularly the public, shared and often state-sponsored acts of remembrance, such as in Britain, Armistice and Remembrance Days, the Burial of the Unknown Warrior in 1920, and the range of commemorative events that have been produced as central aspects of the centenary of the Great War in Britain since 2014. However, we're less good at thinking through the ways that death is remembered in the less public, less collective realm of the family, the individual, and other groups that may not be a part of this public world of remembrance, and if they are, may remember differently away from the public ceremonies and other public narratives of memory. And we're also less good at thinking through the impact of civilian death in war and the ways that these deaths are and are not commemorated in the public sphere. So in this short talk today, I just want to raise some issues around the marginality of these histories to our understanding of wartime death and thus of war itself, and to think this through with regards to the marginality of death in our history and memory of the Second World War in Britain, particularly when compared to the ways we write, think and remember the Great War. So death and its long-term legacies are central to the history of the Great War in Britain and elsewhere. And we can see this, just for example, in the current wave of commemorative events and works that have marked the centenary of the conflict, such as this famously blood-swept lands and seas of red at the Tower of London in 2014. And Jeremy Deller's, I found actually much more affecting, We're Here Because We're Here, which marked the centenary of the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 2016. And how different this is from the dominant cultural memory of the Second World War. Now, while death is now a part of this memory, in part, I think, originally because of the graphic reimagining of D-Day and the battle for Western Europe seen in the opening scenes of Spielberg Saving Private Ryan, and to an extent, actually, last year in Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, and then in TV series Band of Brothers at the end of the 20th century, it's still, I think, marginal, contained in Britain by the narrative of the good war, the just war. However, while we do remember the deaths of young men in battle, we're not so good at remembering the deaths of large numbers of civilians in the aerial bombardment, both the British victims of German air raids and the European and Asian victims of the far larger bombing war waged by Britain and the United States. And I think there are two areas that we need to consider while we try to take account of this. Firstly, the wider historiographical pattern, and secondly, the politicisation of emotions, especially grief during and following the Second World War. And this is something that continues today. So to take historiography first. In an article that's both thoughtful and, for any of you that know Martin, you won't be surprised to know, combative, the historian Martin Francis argued the historiography of the Second World War is lagging far behind that of the First, marked now, I think, by its interdisciplinary nature and by the early willingness of many First World War historians to engage with cultural history, with gender, with cultural memory and with other disciplines. Francis argues that historians now need to reconceptualise the two wars within a common analytical and conceptual framework, addressing the impact of the experience and memory of the Great War on the Second, not only in political terms, but also to find ways to consider the impact of the Great War on families, on constructions of gender, and on ideas about the home and the home front in wartime. Equally, the experience and memory of the Great War shaped the lives of those preparing for the Second in ways that were both numerous and everyday. As ever, mass observation is an excellent source for historians interested in the everyday and in the ways that individuals subjectively negotiate with and experience the grand sweep of history, the large-scale political events that shape our lives, but from which the individual, particularly the individual with little or no access to power, is often written out of. For some, such as the Kent housewife, who wrote for Mass Observation on Armistice Day 1937, that smoke from a garden bonfire, and I quote, looks like poison gas this morning, the past leaked into the present in unwelcome and uncanny ways. As Joel Morley, who's here, who's over there, and my colleague Essex Michael Roper have both shown, one of the primary legacies of the Great War was the way that its effects were enacted on loved ones. When Mass Observation ran a door-to-door survey on Armistice Day 1938, shortly after the Munich crisis and Gas Mask Sunday, they found plenty of evidence of these effects. One woman argued that Remembrance Day was needed, despite its impact on her father, whose son had been killed, her brother had been killed. And her father, when he heard the signal for the 2 minute silence, and again I quote, goes off into a fit because it makes him think of the lad killed. And another woman who wished the whole thing could be forgotten because my sister's husband was killed. She goes all to pieces on that day. My husband was there and it makes him miserable now. So Armistice Day was, of course, a date on which remembrance of the past conflict was foregrounded and encouraged. It was enabled and allowed. But it also appeared time and time again in a range of different places, times and relationships. Francis recounts a story, recorded again in a Mass Observation diary, of a man whose hair went white and who started to suffer from panic attacks and digestive problems when war was declared in 1939. Dying prematurely in spring of 1940, aged just 50. His friend, the diarist, wrote that she was certain his illness was caused by memories of his service in the Great War and his fears about the probability that his son would have to serve in the Second. For many of those listening to Chamberlain's broadcast announcing war with Germany on the morning of the 3rd of September 1939, with trepidation, with sadness, with anticipation and sometimes with relief, memories of the Great War were strong. Even those who'd not experienced the earlier conflict as adults felt its weight. a 20-year-old bank clerk listening to the broadcast at home in Bradford and waiting to be called up for military service, reflected in his mass observation diary that I shall probably soon be dead, continuing, but I do want the final piece this time. An older man travelling back to East London after listening to the declaration with the crowds that had gathered in Whitehall to listen to it sort of in place, observed as their underground train stopped at Blackfriars that it was here that a bomb fell during the last war, much to his wife's and the rest of the tube carriage's disquiet. A final way in which the memory and experience of the Great War shaped the second, I want to just flag up, was in the plans for the burial and commemoration of the dead. The Imperial War Graves Commission, founded in the First World War to ensure the honourable burial of dead combatants by the state, bequeathed both an organisational framework and a widely accepted set of material and cultural memorials for interring and commemorating the military dead. Bodies would, as in the Great War, be buried close to where they fell, with all possible attempts made to identify them and to mark the place of burial. As battle moved on, they'd be collected up and reinterred in concentrated burial grounds, the most famous probably, and certainly the largest on the Western Front, being Tyne Cot in Belgium, close to Ypres and Passchendaele. Their bodies would be placed beneath largely uniform headstones, which emphasised their military identity over and above their civilian one. The cemeteries were dominated by a cross of remembrance, which you can see there in the middle, again demonstrating the continuities between remembrance of the dead of the Great War and planning for the dead of the Second. I just want to give you a couple of examples of Second World War cemeteries so you can see how they do very, very consciously follow this model. So here's El Alamein, one of the big cemeteries, concentrated cemeteries. El Alamein in Libya in North Africa. And Monte Cassino Cemetery, site of a large battle in Italy. Again, there's a cross of remembrance there. Although, as in the Great War, this planning often worked better in the rooms of Whitehall rather than in practice, particularly in the Far East, where climate and wildlife often combined to make individual graves difficult to recover towards the end of the war. And the traditions of burial and remembrance from the Great War served the British and Imperial State fairly well as a model for the disposal, and that's the term they use, disposal, of the military dead well into the late 20th century, with bodies only being brought home from burial or cremation by the families in 1982 in the aftermath of the Falklands Malvinas Wars, the first time that bodies of British soldiers are brought back to Britain. Nonetheless, although the memory of the Great War cast a long shadow over anticipation of the Second, and the ways that the Great War had been represented continued to feed into representations of the very different people's war, these were entangled with a sense that the coming war would be very different. Perhaps the key difference for many of those who experienced the Second World War on the British home front was the centrality of aerial bombardment. Although Britain had been attacked from the air during the Great War, with just over 1,600 killed in air raids from Zeppelin and Goffer airplanes, air power theory and the subsequent development of the heavy bomber between the wars meant that most were anticipating a very different kind of war on the home front than had been experienced between 1914 and 1918. Although poison gas, one of the great fears of the interwar period, was not used against civilians as part of air raids, as had been widely predicted, many were nonetheless killed by aerial bombardment. Just over 60,000 civilians in Britain, between 50 and 60,000 in France, itself actually a largely forgotten aspect of the Allied bombing campaign, approximately 410,000 in Germany, and according to the US Strategic Bombing Survey, around 330,000 in Japan, and that figure includes over 105,000 who died in the 1945 fire bombing of Tokyo. And while memories of these multiple dead have been held in family remembrance and in stories passed on through the generations, they've remained largely absent from or marginal to dominant cultural memory of the war for a range of shared and also nationally specific reasons. In Germany, it's been argued, the Holocaust and a need to recognise Nazi crimes against humanity and subsequent sense that civilians were somehow complicit in these crimes meant that victims of air raids were difficult to remember on the public stage. Memorials were erected, but they were often little known. Dresden, which I showed earlier, the site of the best-known and most criticised Allied air raid, became a locus for the far right in German memory wars, and they were very effective. They've been very effective at mobilising the horrors of Dresden to create a politicised sense of German victimhood and Allied war crimes. The Cold War, the need for Germany, France, Britain and the United States to rapidly reinvent themselves as allies, shaped remembrance in both Germany and France, where debates instead came to focus more on the crimes of Vichy and life under occupation. In Japan, the firebombing of Tokyo was overshadowed by the memory of the use of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, both mobilised by the peace movement during the Cold War as examples of the horror of total war in the nuclear age. In Britain, the memory of the People's War and the so-called Blitz spirit appeared again and again at different points in the post-war period, most notably for me, actually, in the aftermath of the July 2005 tube and bus bombings here in London, when Londoners were urged to demonstrate the Blitz spirit in newspapers and take courage from the determination of the veterans who were descending on London that week for celebrations to mark the 60th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. From memory, there was a giant spam fritter frying event in Hyde Park. The ubiquitous keep calm and carry on slogan, drawn on so effectively by the coalition government, together with we're all in it together, as a means of countering opposition to austerity measures, presenting them instead as something quintessentially British and rooted in our shared experience of austerity during and after the Second World War, left little space to the memory of the civilian war dead in its focus on stoicism, on collectivity and on carrying on. But the difficulty of remembering the civilian dead of war was not something that only became apparent in the post-war period. Instead, it was inherent in the state's attempts to manage these new dead of war and to make them, to paraphrase the historian Thomas Lecure, work for the nation during the war itself. So in the rest of this talk, then, I want to turn to the management of the civilian war dead during the war in an attempt to begin to account for their relative marginality in our cultural memory of the Second World War in contemporary Britain. So while the traditions of the Great War ensured some measure of both referential stability and a mechanism for remembrance of the military dead, it was much harder to ensure this stability and thus ensure public remembrance for the civilian corpse. Civilians were central to the Second World War, not simply as a collective body whose contribution to the war effort could be measured through their willingness to endure the multiple demands of wartime, loss, evacuation, rationing, conscription, but also through their ability to withstand aerial bombardment. Since Douay's Command of the Air was first published in 1921, air power theorists had repeated the mantra that the next war would be won or lost on the ability of civilian populations to withstand aerial bombardment. One key aspect of this withstanding, British planners believed, was an understanding that the bodies of the dead would be treated with the same reverence as that shown to the bodies of the military dead. So while the British state had been planning for the protection and management of civilians in any future war since 1924, it was not until 1936, following the German remilitarisation of the Rhineland and the outbreak of the Civil War in Spain, that the secret interdisciplinary burial civilians committee began to meet and plan for the burial of civilians who were going to be targeted by enemy action. And from the outset, this committee was concerned to ensure that bodies could be buried quickly and that relatives of the dead would feel, if the bodies were buried by the state via the local authority in Britain, that they'd been treated with the same kind of reverence shown to the military dead. As enormous numbers of casualties were expected, particularly at the outbreak of war, when statisticians were predicting a daily aggregate of 18,000 corpses, so they were predicting a daily aggregate of 18,000 dead in the first few weeks of war, largely in London and the mouth of the Thames. Mass burial of casualties by local authorities was seen as a key aspect of this planning. It was seen as an efficient way of both disposing of large numbers of bodies quickly and so avoiding predicted problems of both disease and of lowered morale that it was believed would result from repeated individual burials. Mass burials and burials by the local authority, however, were unpopular. They were long associated in Britain with a pauper's funeral, an unmarked burial in a mass grave. While the burial of combatants' bodies by the Imperial War Graves Commission had helped to alleviate some of the shame associated with internment by the state, the idea of the common grave, where unmarked bodies were piled on top of one another, remained a powerful signifier of disgrace, a final reminder of the lack of public esteem and significance of those so buried. In order to try and avoid the connotations of the pauper's grave, attempts were made by national and local authorities to instead surround mass wartime burials with the status of the military burials carried out by the Imperial War Graves Commission. If civilians were to be buried communally by the state, it was vital that such burials conveyed a sense of reverence and respect that had been successfully associated with military interments. In some cases, this was successful, in others not. And I just want to go on now to discuss a couple of examples of successful and unsuccessful burials by the state. So successful first. When the small industrial town of Coventry in the West Midlands was bombed overnight on the 14th or 15th of November 1940, the immediate impact was devastating. Coventry was the first city outside of London to suffer a heavy air raid. And when Tom Harrison of Mass Observation arrived to assess morale the following day, he described a scene of, and I quote, unprecedented dislocation and depression, as inhabitants of the city struggled to come to terms with the destruction. Writing to her daughter 2 days later, one woman described Coventry as a city of the dead, utterly devastated, with rumours of thousands buried underneath the Market Hall, Owen Owens, a department store, and other shelters. The majority of these dead were buried in 2 collective funerals in common graves. 172 were buried together on the 20th of November, and another 250 5 days later. But these funerals, far from undermining morale further in the shattered city, appear to have acted as a means through which the community came together, united not only in grief, but in a desire to mark the dead and support the bereaved. In this, they were joined by representatives of the city, the military, civil defence and of different churches. Recorded by Pathé for a film called The Tragedy of Coventry and widely reported not only in Britain but also in the United States, the funerals functioned to recognise the suffering of the city, embodied here, and this is the long grave in the first funeral, embodied here in the corpses of its civilian victims and in the grief of the bereaved who are walking past. The carefully choreographed funerals succeeded in attaching a political value to the dead that in its turn seems to have served to reassure the bereaved that their loved ones were being treated with reverence and with respect by the state. So although the War Office had warned against using the term common grave to describe mass burials such as this, where the dead were laid side to side in long trench graves, the term was nonetheless widely used in press and media. Reporting on the first funeral for the BBC European News, Harrison described how they buried the dead of Coventry yesterday in a common grave. The whole town mourned for these dead, most of them women and children, all of them citizens and civilians. The two funerals acted to successfully mask the chaos, confusion and anguish that had immediately followed the raids. The nearby newspaper, the Birmingham Post, emphasising instead that the citizens of Coventry died with all the honour of those who fell in the frontline trenches. The widespread coverage of the suffering of Coventry, with the King visiting the city in the days following the raid, and dignitaries and the international press attending the funerals, helped these mass funerals to accomplish a referential stability for the corpses that were being interred. The dead of Coventry, dying as civilians but buried like soldiers, continued to work for the war effort, representing the communal sacrifice of those dying, and this is from the New York Times coverage, dying in the world's battle for liberty and freedom. So the dead of Coventry then were successfully put to work by the state, their bodies and the funeral and burial rites which surrounded them acting to convey a sense of solidarity and sacrifice that acted to oppose the Nazi brutality that had caused their deaths. Civilians could also be good soldiers, but their worth in death came from the ways in which they could be made to embody and signify a sense of community, of collective determination, and a willingness to sacrifice life for the common good. By honouring the civilian war dead at their gravesides, the British state attempted not only to ensure referential stability to these bodies, guaranteeing that they would represent collectivity in the face of an external enemy, but also to avoid the connotations of dishonour and a lack of remembrance that clung to the idea of the common grave. In order for this stability to be assured, the bereaved had to feel their grief was recognised and their suffering acknowledged. While this appears to have been the case in Coventry, other mass burials following air raids often failed to convey this sense of unity and solidarity that was so necessary to ensure the dead had value for the wartime nation. One of the clearest ways in which the worth attached to the dead by the bereaved and attached to them by the state failed to match was financial. When four generations of one family were killed by a bomb that fell while they were celebrating their baby daughter's christening in November 1940, the Daily Mirror accused their local council, Wembley Corporation, of being profiteers in death. The council had buried all six of the dead together in one grave and had charged the surviving family members an extra 7 shillings for burying the baby, Monica Mary, in the same coffin as her mother. Now, for a readership familiar with the carefully costed and Spartan nature of local authority burials of the poor on the parish, this would have come as an unwelcome reminder of the low value the state placed upon the bodies of those that it buried. Unsurprisingly, the majority of those who could do so chose to bury their loved ones' bodies themselves, rather than rely upon the goodwill of a state which, as this case seemed to demonstrate, was not always successful and conveying a sense of honour and reverence in its interment practices. While many chose to bury their own dead, this was not always possible. 4 weeks after the London Blitz had started, a driver with the London Auxiliary Ambulance Service wrote his commanders to London County Hall and the Home Secretary asking to be relieved of his post. The reason he gave was an article in the Sunday Chronicle, which claimed that last week, a number of Poplar ARP workers were killed on duty. Those men died in the service of their country as surely as if they'd been in the front line. They were taken to the cemetery in a lorry. They were buried in a common grave. No representative of the authorities graced a burial service. King George has instituted the George Cross for heroes such as these men were, yet they were given only a lorry for a hearse. The letter was signed, and I think this is really interesting, driver C.H.A. Flashman, London Authority Ambulance Service, driver since October 1939, Devonshire Regiment, 1917 to 18, thus claiming both a linkage between military service and service in civil defence and an authority associated with this past military service. In this instance, the hurried burial of civil defence volunteers in the midst of repeated air raids failed to attribute the necessary sense of value to their bodies. Instead, interred in haste in a common grave in one of the poorest areas of London, their burial bore all the markers of the pauper's grave. Despite repeated claims that civil defence was the civilian equivalent of military service, burials like these seem to have been devoid of the sense of honour and reverence that had come to surround those entombed in the war grave cemeteries on the Western Front. As the Blitz spread outside of London, the government became further concerned about the impact of mass burials on public morale. Minutes of an interdepartmental conference held at the Ministry of Housing and local government in November 1940 record some of these concerns, as those attending agreed that local authorities should be advised to send a representative to both mass funerals and the funerals of civil defence workers, in order to convey communal respect, gratitude and sympathy. Special vehicles should be purchased to convey bodies to the place of burial, and if shrouds were to be used in place of coffins, these should be painted purple or black, and the authorities should consider placing them in the grave before relatives arrived. Despite attempts such as this to ensure that mass funerals and burial in common graves appeared as distinct from pauper funerals, the majority of people continued to prefer private burial to burial by the state, and indeed it was not uncommon for relatives to request that bodies be removed from a common grave at a later date, either because those buried as unidentified had been subsequently identified, or because the family had raised the finances necessary for a private funeral, as was sometimes the case before the war in pauper funerals. When the small industrial town of Clydebank, just to the west of Glasgow, experienced heavy air raids in March 1941, the mass funeral and collective burial of many of the victims markedly failed to convey the sense of collectivity, sympathy and resolution that had been seen in Coventry. Clyde Bank had been poorly prepared. Many of its inhabitants, as in nearby Glasgow, had sought shelter in the close of their tenement or in the brick-built ground shelter in the backyard, and neither of these offered effective protection from the heavy explosive and incendiaries that were dropped overnight on the 13th and 14th of March. The eventual death toll was at least 528, although many local residents insisted it was higher. In the immediate aftermath of the raid, the civic infrastructure of the small town broke down, and while Coventry, where the same thing happened, had been able to receive help and support from nearby Glasgow, little help was forthcoming from Glasgow, which was also struggling to cope with the results of heavy raids on the same two nights. Rumours were widespread. Thousands, not hundreds, had been killed, and the government in faraway London was determined to suppress news of the disaster. And against this backdrop, it's perhaps unsurprising that the common burial of some of the town's dead was unable to convey the same sense of unity that was seen in Coventry. Clyde Bank found it was suffering from a shortage of grave diggers, coffins and Union Jacks, which were to be used as pals put over the coffins. The local mortuary services were overwhelmed, and Mr. McRobbie, sent from the Department of Health in Edinburgh to aid the mortuary service, wrote of the chaos and confusion at the temporary mortuary. He wrote, "Bodies were lying on the floor as they'd been brought in. There was much overcrowding. The police took photos of such unidentified bodies as were likely to photograph sufficiently well for subsequent identification." Observing the chaos in Clyde Bank, McRobbie quickly came to the conclusion that mass burial of the unclaimed bodies was the only practicable method. So by the 16th of March, there were 66 unclaimed bodies at this temporary mortuary. 18 had been identified but not claimed for private burial. McRobbie arranged for these bodies to be buried in a trench grave in the town's Dalmotta Road Cemetery, with a small number of bodies being added to the grave the following day. Unlike Coventry, the funeral and burial service was not widely covered in the press and was recorded in McRobbie's report as, while not to be publicised, not to be kept secret. There were not enough lorries, drivers or other workers to easily transport the bodies to the cemetery, and McRobbie had to enlist 4 ALP volunteers as bearers to carry the bodies from the mortuary to lorries, a task they found distressing. At the cemetery, a burial service was conducted by Catholic and Protestant clergy as the bodies were being unloaded, and wreaths were laid next to the long grave. Sorry, I should have shown that earlier. That's part of the town just straight after the raids, and this is the one photo that remains that I've been able to find of the burial. And wreaths were laid next to the long grave by the Secretary of State for Scotland and the District Commissioner for Civil Defence. After this official party had left, the unloading was completed and the bodies were covered over. And disquiet about the nature of the funeral and burial and problems of identifying the bodies of the victims began to be voiced almost immediately. The Daily Record described the burial of the nameless dead, reporting unknown victims of the Nazi onslaught on the Clydeside town were buried yesterday in a common grave, so that term again, but it's got different meaning here. After observing the funeral, the district commissioner, Stephen Bisland, complained about the lack of coffins, about delays in taking the dead to the cemetery, and the presence of only 2 grave diggers to receive the bodies, meaning the interment was a long and slow process. Given the disorder and the chaos in Clyde Bank in the aftermath of the raid, and the perception that the state was failing to recognise both the enormity of the town's ordeal and the suffering of both dead and the bereaved, it's unsurprising the vast majority of those who were able to identify their loved ones chose to bury them in private funerals and in single graves. In Clyde Bank, then, the political value attached to the civilian dead by the state failed to equal their emotional value for the bereaved. So in Clyde Bank, unlike Coventry, the dead did not achieve a referential stability, nor were they able to carry out useful work for the wartime nation. They didn't come to stand for a national and indeed international unity. Instead, the dead of Clyde Bank continued to disrupt the narrative of unity in the face of an external enemy long after their demise. A year later, local residents remained sceptical about official numbers for those killed. On the first anniversary of the raid, the Sunday Post claimed even greater numbers of fatalities, stating that today Clyde Bank pays tribute to the memory of 1,200 people, mostly women and children, who lost their lives as a result of the savage two-night blitz on the town a year ago. While the dead of Coventry then acted as symbols of unity, and as a reminder of the need to avenge their deaths by defeating the Nazi enemy, the restless, disruptive death of Clydebank served to emphasise both the new vulnerability of civilians to modern weaponry and a distrust in the wartime state that could undermine the morale that was so necessary to national unity. So just some thoughts in conclusion then. While both the military and the civilian dead of the Second World War are less central to our cultural memory of that conflict than the ever-present dead of the Great War, it's the civilian dead who remain truly marginal. In part, this can be traced back to the war years, the combination of a lack of established structure for managing the civilian dead, the chaos that all too often surrounded mass civilian burials, and the emotional economy of stoicism that has made historical records of grief and bereavement hard to come by, combining to ensure that in the immediate aftermath of war, there was little discussion or commemoration of these dead. While the military dead were incorporated into the ceremonies of Armistice Day, reimagined as Remembrance Sunday from 1945, the only civilians to be formally remembered in these ceremonies were civil defence workers who lost their lives working to defend their communities. And it's only relatively recently, following the memory boom of the late 20th century, that the civilian dead of war have started to reappear. There's a range of factors that might help to account for this. The desire to look back and somehow understand the devastating wars of the 20th century at its close. The realisation that the generation who experienced the Second World War are ageing, and a desire to listen to and to tell stories while we're still able. The 50th anniversaries of significant wartime events in the late 1990s, and the growth of new and social media, providing opportunities for stories to be deposited and collected, as on the BBC People's War site, and on local websites, like this one in Bath, where historians have been able to research and tell the stories of their hometowns during the war. Perhaps also the wars of the early 21st century, reminding us of the often devastating impact of war on civilians, has contributed to a wave of remembering, seen not only in websites and stories, such as those held in sites like the Bath website, but in the creation of new physical memorials to the civilian dead of war in a number of British towns and cities. So just, for example, this is the Exeter Memorial. Exeter was badly hit in the Baedeker raids. The Liverpool Memorial, and this is the main London Memorial to the civilian war dead down the Docklands in Wapping. I think that in this recent wave of both remembering and commemoration, we need to remember the dead of war are still being managed, can still be put to work for the nation, but they also have the power to be disruptive, to speak to us from beyond the grave of the horror and the multiple legacies of wartime. Thank you.
They were very highly organised in principle. Okay, yeah. So in principle, they were organised just up the road in Whitehall. They were organised by politicians and civil servants, and quite sort of direct instructions how this should be managed are sent out to local authorities. In practice, it's often much more chaotic. So in practice, on the ground, it's organised by the local authority. They did try as far as possible to get kind of representatives of the state, either from the local authority or, you know, preferably from the, you know, of the nation state to come along. It wasn't always possible. So I would say that largely they're organised by, you know, the professional classes, by the middle class and by men. The people that are being buried tend to be poor. They tend to be working class, partly because those, you know, those are the areas that are hit, but also because they're often the people who are perhaps less able to
financially manage to bury their dead, because you could get some financial support for that, but to kind of navigate the systems for retrieving the bodies and kind of going through that process. I'm not sure, but that does seem to be a class stratification, perhaps largely because of the places that were bombed. Yeah.
I imagine today's bureaucracy is anything to go by, complicated forms were probably involved.
Yeah. There was a lot of bureaucracy. But one thing that was really interesting, but I've never been able to follow up or find out any more about, was I think it was West Ham. It was one of the East London authorities, and there was a complaint that the burial parties, mortuary parties were turning up to collect bodies, but they were already gone because families were coming and taking them themselves and taking them home. Trying to kind of continue with pre-war traditions of sort of looking after the body yourself and burying it themselves. So they're turning up and there's no body there. Mm. So there were kind of concerns about that. But I've only come across that once. I don't know how widespread it was.
Delighted that you put the Liverpool Memorial to the list.
I can put it up again.
I was just listening to my students. I mean, I adore this, but you can interpret it in many different ways. Yeah. I interpret it as the pleasure culture of war, and I think the child's out of reach and it harms them.
I'm not sure
what the sculpture means. But just in terms of the Liverpool Blitz, are there still things that can't be set? I'm thinking about, I think, one of the most notorious incidents in Liverpool, certainly, was the Derning Road School,
yeah,
where they weren't just bombed, they were scored in the line and it was kind of kept quiet at the time. And there's a reason my nan evacuated because of victims of that. And I just, but that, the kind of the graphicness of that,
yeah,
it's clearly something that was sensitive at the time. But even now, in terms of how we memorialise, there's certain things we can't say about.
We clean it up, don't we, in memorialisation. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a purpose to that because I would hope that the key function of any memorial be that it's not going to make things worse for the bereaved. So I can kind of see the purpose of that. But at the same time, there is that whole kind of process of kind of reification that goes on that I'm uncomfortable with because there are so many ways and so many kind of disparate and often kind of worrying uses that the memories of war, and particularly memory of the Second World War, can be put to in Britain, and we're really seeing that at the moment, I think. So I think it's a really kind of complicated area. It's something that I've had to be really aware of when I'm doing this work, and at the start people kept on saying to me, are you going to do oral history? And I was like, no, because I can't imagine going and asking people about events like that. But it's really interesting.
The figures. So your question is then, well, what happened to those figures?
Yeah.
Whereas the Exeter one and the London one
are
clearly
not for
a far more generic.
Yeah. And I feel the same. I think, oh, he looks really.
Me.
Yeah, but she's reaching out to him. Yeah. It's a really interesting memorial.
Thank you. I'm not sure who was first.
Well, I just wanted to. Okay. Can I just ask about the geography of it as well?
Yeah.
I was wondering with the location of where, with that Clyde Bank example, you had the photograph. I think this was raised in one of your previous talks, maybe, about there's no women in that photograph you shot. And so I wondered about, when it comes to the practices of commemoration, the fact that people can't maybe get to the space of where these cemeteries are. Is that a sort of trend? I suppose it may be contrast to Coventry, where it's located right in the heart of the city and it's quite prominent. Is that?
Yeah, I think the Clyde Bank one especially, and maybe kind of specifically, most people had evacuated and they'd self-evacuated. Women, particularly women with children, had been sent off on buses all over Scotland and down to the north of England. So they simply weren't in the town a few days later for that burials. But at the same time, and I don't know enough about Scottish history, there's also a tradition certainly just not far away from Clyde Bank, but probably actually culturally quite different, in the sort of inner and southern highlands, of women not attending funerals. So I don't know whether any of that has carried over to Clyde Bank. I'd need to know more about kind of patterns of migration and stuff. But it's only Clyde Bank where I've seen women not being not being present, and I think it might be like kind of the specific, probably more to do with people being evacuated than anything else. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for that. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I was wondering about the difference between local and national memory. It seems to me there are places where death is very closely bound up. It is the central fact of local memory.
Mm-hmm.
The war. There's another school example, so South Hawthorne School in East London, because that's the thing that people know as an example of East London identity.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how much official effort went into saying that actually the number of dead was quite limited, the stories we've heard around the local community about there being more people dead, as there always are in these events, were a part of identity.
Yep.
Of course it was being covered up, because that's what they always do to us.
Yeah.
So I wondered whether you say death is absent from...
say marginal.
Death is marginalised, but are there places where actually every other sort of death is marginalised? And it's the civilians who become symbolic of a very distinct identity.
I think you're right, that's really interesting, and I think there are definitely, and I could think of other examples as well, so Liverpool would be one, and it's often that sense, well, we suffered more than anybody else and nobody knows about it. It's where you get in Clyde Bank, Belfast, a few other places, and nobody cares. So, yes, in terms of a local history, you can say that that is kind of, or it was at the time very... very present, and it's kind of, it's reappeared. But I think so. Something like the school in East London, I don't think that many people outside of that area would have known about that until very recently. So there was a TV documentary on it, wasn't there? I think we saw that.
It's
the bombs that changed Britain. But do you think that... So at the time, but since, it's kind of, it's become marginal. It's not part of our kind of popular memory. We remember people singing in shelters, not dying. Foyle's War. Foyle's War has just followed me for 20 years. Okay, so maybe, I think that's a really interesting point. Maybe there are some kind of local histories where it is more visible and perhaps in some cases has become central to that kind of, that history or that identity in war. Actually, I think, you know what, the key one, I think, would be the... Bethnal Green tube station disaster, which everybody says to me, nobody knows about it. I'm like, yes, they do. Everybody knows about it. Like, we weren't allowed to talk about it, but you talk about it all the time. So I think, yeah, I think there are probably some kind of pockets where it's become important, but that hasn't... I still don't think that's filtered through into our dominant popular memory of the war. I wish it would more, actually.
Thank you. That was very interesting. I'm just kind of reflecting on the what you just said just now about Bethnal Green and this idea that something we pretend that it's marginalised when it isn't, or something. I'm not for sure. But I was thinking about the timescale. I was thinking that death is central to war. War is about death. In a way more than anything else. There's something about the timescale here, which is there are three stages. There's a bloody moment of death,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the burial, and then there's the commemoration and the memory of it afterwards. And of course, the commemoration and the memory is very, very long. The bloody moment of death is often very short, but it's dramatic. But somehow, I think you've hit on something about the moment of burial, which is that it's not dramatic. It's somber and it's sad and it's not. It's not memorialized. So there's something about that moment there, which kind of intrinsically, I don't know, that we are doomed to forget it. I'm not sure.
Mm.
Not sure whether that's
I think that's interesting, and I think possibly one of the reasons why Coventry worked is that people, and it might have also been because it's the first big devastating air raid outside of London, is because people were promised right from the start the site of this burial will be marked. We will, as soon as we can, we will erect a kind of a mass memorial over their grave. And I think it's that kind of marking it out from the pauper's grave that perhaps is one of the reasons that persuaded people in Coventry to go along with to actually be happy for their loved ones to be buried in this mass grave rather than to be buried individually. So perhaps it is about the linkage between burial, which I found there's so many examples I could talk about, fascinating, between burial and memorialisation, and I think it's perhaps when bodies were buried in common graves and then relatives felt that they weren't being properly kind of honoured or memorialised, often quite a long time after the event, that was still causing problems to the British state after the war. They were still getting requests from people who wanted bodies exhumed because they didn't feel that they were being treated with enough reverence. And there's all kinds of panics in Whitehall about, we don't know which one they are. We can't possibly start doing this. What do we say to them? So I think it's, so maybe there's a fourth stage there about the kind of like the physical memorialisation that goes on or doesn't.
I hope a question will come out here. I guess one of the things I don't think you talked about was, I mean, death is a, there are institutions who talk a lot about death, and they're religious institutions. Mm. So I guess my question is, what are churches saying about civilian deaths? I mean, I think the three of the people in that figure are churchmen.
Yeah.
And so are they saying anything in particular about civilian deaths that's different to the way in which they're talking about military deaths, and if so, what is it? And I guess, my sense would be, and I don't know what that is, and I guess I would be one of the few people in the world who's read every edition of the Church Times during the year.
So I need to talk to you then.
And in a sense, one of the things that the really interesting things about that the Church becomes much more concerned about damage to physical property than you would expect. So it features every week something which is about which churches have been destroyed. So I just wonder whether, but is there a narrative that somehow, a religious narrative about civilian death, I guess is my question.
The main one, and I haven't read every copy of the Church Times, I've read some, the main one seems to be they consciously use that language of sacrifice, again, which gets used for the military dead. I think that's probably the key one. And I'm thinking of one particular example, but it's too long to go into. I might try and grab you later to talk to you about this example. But it's very similar. What I've seen is very, very similar to that language sacrifice. So even when it's children in schools that have been killed, they talk about them as, you know, the nation's dead, a sacrifice, and you must avenge their death. So sacrifice and kind of avenging, actually.
Yeah, we've got time for one more.
Mentioned that a lot of private citizens took their loved ones and buried them privately.
Yes.
And it makes me think of a question about are there any differences between those memorials or graves in comparison with ordinary civilian deaths due to non-military reasons? And when comparing between those common or mass graves and other mass graves constructed by the war graves commemoration committee, are there any differences? Are they well maintained today? For example, the Coventry grave?
Yeah, Coventry is well maintained. They did that. So the difference is that the civilian graves aren't maintained by the Imperial War Graves or the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So they don't have that same model. Sometimes there's some sense that they would. I wish I had some examples to show you. So they tend to be very simple and very kind of inclusive in their simplicity. So they don't usually have kind of religious symbols kind of in them. In terms of the individual burials by the family, what I've seen, they very, very rarely mention that people have died because of air raids or because of enemy action. That's very, very rarely mentioned. And in fact, there was a memo in civil service towards the end of the war saying, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something like, the common person seems very averse to remembering that their relatives have died as a result of war actions. They want to just remember them sort of differently and outside of that. So there was a sense that people didn't always want their relatives to be kind of incorporated into the wartime state and death. They wanted to keep them for themselves. And I think that's reflected on the kind of gravestone markers.
There is a stigma of death due to air raids that people tended to reverse in comparison with death in the battlefield, which has a linkage of heroism instead of victim.
It's victimhood, I guess, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy, and thank you for a wonderful keynote.